Good morning. You're on the air with Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Next 2 hours, it's going to be civil rights on the streets here in Santa Cruz, up in San Francisco, and as far away as Philadelphia, where a march to the UN is going to be happening, perhaps even as we speak.
Lots of interviews.
Lots of commentary from me. Not much music, I'm afraid. Maybe a little poetry. This is indeed Bathroom Spears Broadsides, the June 22nd edition. June 22nd, 1997.
Glad to have you with us.
If you want to comment on anything you hear in the show that's going on, and you are in fact listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, give a call to me, Bathroom Spear Robert Norris, at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, HUFF. HUFF is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, an organization I've been working with for 7, 8 years now. Want to join up? Hey, we'd love to have you. Right now we're in the midst of numerous projects, like monitoring the Downtown Association's hoaxy Real Change, Not Spare Change program, where they give away little yellow slips of paper to panhandlers instead of coins, or courtesy. A little courtesy, a little respect for people's situation might be a little better. We're also concerned with the depopulation of the downtown area as far as homeless poor people go. You may have noticed that Cathcart and Pacific, Hippie Corner, Friendship Corner, as it used to be called, is now almost completely empty of people that used to be there. Due in large part to a dedicated effort by the police, city departments, and merchants. Police first moved people across the street to Cat and Canary, the area there where they lounge on benches, until the benches were physically, bodily removed from that corner. If you go down to that corner of Cathcart and Pacific, you'll see there are no benches next to the Cat and Canary store. Now, whether that can be done legally without a public hearing, perhaps it can be legally done. Obviously, there's a moral question here, whether the city services serve the merchants or the general community that needs those benches, not to mention the residents of the hotel that need a place to sit at the El Centro Apartments, which is right above that area. We're going to be exploring a lot of things, and you can explore them with us by listening to the show, by joining HUFF, by keeping your own eyes and ears open and supporting civil rights on the streets for people when you see them under attack. Got lots of interviews coming up, including Keith McHenry, another with Pat Circle and Gary Wood of the Human Rights Defense Committee, San Jose Food Not Bombs activists. Well, we got a bunch. We're chock full of stuff today. So stay by your radio, and let's hear Jesse Cox first of all. Jesse is an activist with the Kensington Welfare Rights Group, which is marching from Philadelphia to the UN to demand justice for welfare recipients and to expose the illegality of laws and police practices throughout the country around the welfare rights cuts, welfare cash cuts, or the actual demolition of the AFDC system. Talking to us from Philadelphia, she's with the, you're with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union?
Uh-huh.
What's this group? How long has it been around, and what are you up to?
The Kensington Welfare Rights Union has been around for about 6 years. We're a member of the National Welfare Rights Union, which has been around for about 30 years. And the Kensington Welfare Rights Union was formed in 1991 by a group of homeless mothers and children of all races in Philadelphia who came together to fight for housing, food, and clothing, and to get what they need to survive.
Have you been successful?
We've won housing for over 450 families in the Philadelphia area over the last several years through housing takeovers, tent cities, different kinds of protests, and we've met the clothing, utilities, and food needs of poor people throughout Philadelphia, as well as developing poor families as leaders in the fight for their own survival.
How many people are in the union?
We have hundreds of members and about 20 who are in the leadership on a daily basis.
Have you done anything in the last 3 or 4 months that you think is worth mentioning?
Well, we've been trying to set up a tent city in Philadelphia for the last couple months, and the city has stopped us about 10 times from setting up a tent city for homeless families to live since the shelters are closed. And right now we're preparing to march to the United Nations, which will leave this Saturday, June 21st. And we'll be marching for 10 days to the United Nations to protest the welfare cut and demand the right to food, housing, and clothing for every man, woman, and child.
How many homeless people would you estimate there are in Philadelphia?
I think the official estimate is several tens of thousands. It's about 30,000 or something.
And what is your estimate?
Oh, gosh. I can't really say. I mean, it's definitely more than the city estimate. Most of the homeless are families who double up with families or live in cars or parks or kind of the hidden homeless that we see every day in our communities.
Is it legal to sleep in your vehicle in Philadelphia if you're homeless?
I don't actually know. But they just passed an anti-feeding law in Philadelphia.
Tell us about that.
So in one of the major parks in Philadelphia, you can't even eat. And they've just imposed major fines on people for feeding.
Has that actually been enforced?
Philadelphia. I think minimally. I don't know if there haven't been any major cases so far that I've heard of.
Philadelphia, you talked to Food Not Bombs, has, of course, done a lot of research on that subject. And
right.
I went to jail a year ago for serving people free food. I was actually declared a prisoner of conscience for for serving bagels and rice because I was being held for political reasons. Amnesty International made that determination. And San Francisco, of course, has had really a high proportion of, it's had its lion's share of the harassment.
Right.
You say Philadelphia is having that. Is this something new in Philadelphia? Or?
It's been a law on and off for the last several years in Philadelphia. They've tightened the rules recently. The new law is something particularly strong, but it's been on the books for several years.
Have you noticed an upsurge in people on the streets as a consequence of cuts?
Definitely. And we've been having more and more people calling our union looking for help with, you know, mainly homelessness.
So, for example, from a year ago, what would you say is the increase in the homeless population as a consequence of SSI and welfare cuts?
I can't say in hard numbers, but I would definitely say that we've seen a real increase. We've seen a lot more calls coming in to us, and walking through the community can definitely see the impact.
Do you have a Food Not Bombs in Philadelphia?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Are they being harassed by the police?
I don't know specifically about Food Not Bombs, but I know that there are different organizations. We, for example, have been trying to set up this tent city for homeless families, and we've met a lot of resistance from the cops. We had 7 people arrested 2 weeks ago for trying to set up shacks on a vacant lot for families to live in.
Now, is this the first time you've done this in Philadelphia, or is this simply the most recent effort? When did the last such effort occur?
We've had tent cities pretty much every year since our founding, about 5 or 6 years ago. And 2 years ago, we had a tent city for 3 months in Kensington, which is the poorest neighborhood in Pennsylvania, in Philadelphia, and then took over an abandoned church after that for 3 months. And then took over abandoned houses for 3 months in a struggle for housing. And we were able to win houses for several of the leaders who emerged out of that struggle.
Is Philadelphia the city from which the National Union of the Homeless initially came out of?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that the Oakland Union of the Homeless took over numerous houses and abandoned buildings in the late 80s and early 90s and successfully converted it into low-income stuff for families,
right.
Previously homeless families.
Right.
Is the National Union of the Homeless still around, or are you the successor organization, or what's happened with that?
The National Union of the Homeless is still around, and we've worked with them for the last several years.
So they're going to be on this march as well.
There may be membership participating in the march. Yeah, it's being led by the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, but the Union of the Homeless is.
So do you have any specific demands or any particular concerns you're going to bring to the UN specifically in terms of what you want? Are you, for example, pressing a lawsuit under international law? What's the story there?
We're carrying documentation of what's been happening to poor and homeless people throughout the country since the welfare cuts went into effect, and we're pulling that all together and carrying it in a coffin, which is going to be presented when we arrive there on July 1st, and we're going to be presenting that information to a tribunal of community members at the UN and also in a press conference and to the general public at that time, and telling the stories of what's been happening to people who have committed suicide because they've been cut off of welfare, people who have been thrown into the streets because they've been cut off, children who have died in house fires because their parents couldn't afford decent housing, all different kinds of atrocities that we're seeing in different parts of this country as a result of being poor, and more recently as a result of the welfare cuts.
I was a part of a demonstration recently at the San Francisco Presidio where we tried with religious witness for the homeless to persuade the federal government, which controls that area, to release 466 units of now abandoned military housing for use by the San Francisco homeless. This is the latest in a series of nonviolent civil disobedient actions by religious witness, Food Not Bombs, and other groups. The response has been, of course, to stonewall, but every time the demonstrations get bigger. Your tent cities in Philadelphia, have they been largely symbolic affairs, or are you actually proposing them as sort of Clintonvilles, real areas where people will go to live? Because
the tent city 2 years ago had about 40 families. The tent city we did last year, which we named Ridgeville after our governor who cut medical aid and welfare last year, Tom Ridge, we named it Ridgeville last year, and that also included about 30, 40 families. And the tent city that we've been trying to set up this year is called Schmitzville, which is named after the Schmitz Brewery, which is a factory which left. We have hundreds of factories in our community which just left the community and left thousands of people without jobs in the last 10, 20 years. And so we named it Schmitzville.
How can people who cannot attend the march, like myself, support you? Do you have an address that folks should write to, a number that folks should call, an email address that people should get online and send stuff to?
Yeah, we have, you can call 215-763-4584.
Repeat that number, could you?
I can repeat that, 215-763-4586. And we have an email number at kwru@libertynet.org. And we also have a web page, which is http://www.libertynet.org/KWRU. And we can be reached at any of those. We need resources, we need contributions of cash and all sorts of different materials. We need letters of support to be sent to us. We need people to have rallies in their own communities in support of us when we arrive at the UN on July 1st. We need people to contact local press and just kind of get the word out about what we're doing throughout this country and in different parts of the world, to tell people what we're doing and unite with us and make a united stand against what's going on here.
And for those who didn't get those numbers, you can give a call locally to 423-4833 here at Huff headquarters, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and we'll give you those numbers and addresses, and you can get in touch with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union to show your support. Maybe you can write a letter to the local paper talking about this issue so that their July 1st action will be echoed in different places throughout the country. Is there more you want to tell us about, Jenny, before we move along?
I think that's it. Just thank you for having me, and we'd really like to have support, and we appreciate what people are doing in different parts of the country. And
great.
We know we all need to fight against this stuff.
No question.
Together.
Okay, it's...
And that was Jesse Cox of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, talking about the march, 10-day march to the United Nations. If you want to get that number again, give me a call at 423-4833, and I'll be happy to get it back to you. We've been having local protests as well, actually not quite local, just over the hill in San Jose. Last Tuesday, the San Jose City Council was faced with a significant protest by 60 or 70 people in a drum circle. The protest focused on police harassment of young homeless people and the drum circle they had had before it was broken up by police, not apparently on the basis of any complaints from neighbors, but simply because the police were interested in removing young people from public spaces. How you can send young people home who don't have a home under curfew laws is a great mystery to me. Anyway, we're talking here to Pat Circle. Pat is one of the workers with Human Rights Defense Committee over in San Jose, which has been concerned with human rights cases. And we're going to not only hear her, we're going to hear interviews with other members of that group talking about this demonstration last Tuesday at San Jose City Council. On the line with Pat Circle. Pat, you're a member of the Human Rights Defense Committee, right? That's right.
Right, uh-huh.
So, you were in a demonstration last night at City Hall, and you've been talking to me about this, but people on the air haven't heard what it's about. Can you briefly fill us in on what happened at that demonstration at City Hall and why it came about?
Sure. We called it Drum for Justice, and it started because some of the youngsters had come to us for help. They have a drum group, and it's a circle of drums, and they meet usually at Guadalupe Park and just have their drums and just hang out there. And the police have been giving them a real bad time. There's been some cases of beatings. There's been tickets. Just really bad harassment, and they're afraid. They're afraid to complain. One youngster asked for a police officer's name, and the cop got very ugly with him and gave him a ticket for obstructing justice or some ridiculous thing. And so they've had a lot of problems. And so we wrote a letter, the committee, and sent a copy to Mayor Hammer, the chief of police, the city council, asking if we could meet with them and, find why this is going on when the kids are staying off the street like they, the police want them off the streets and this is what they're doing. Well, of course, we received no response whatsoever. So we decided to hold this Drum for Justice in front of City Hall when there would be a city council meeting. And we brought lots of food for the kids, for anybody that showed up. We had a group of drums there, some of them with the Brazilian martial arts team, and some of them just, people hearing about the demonstration that brought their drums. It was very effective. I would say at one time I counted about 60 people.
And this happened between, 6 and 9 o'clock in front of...
9, uh-huh, correct.
That's the Tuesday evening session of the San Jose City Council?
Right. The meeting up there starts at 7. We started at 6.
And you understand you did a lot of feeding people?
Yes. We had lots of food there. In fact, when I left at 8:30, there was still so much food left out there. So there was plenty of food for everybody.
And what were you feeding people? This, I guess, was with the group San Jose's Food Not Bombs?
Right, uh-huh. And then one of our members, Gary Wood, also brought just... tons and tons of chicken and soft drink. So we had quite a variety. There was just sandwiches, salads, just all kinds of things.
Now, there's been a new law passed in San Jose that makes it illegal to sit down.
Yes, that's right.
Was that also a concern of the Human Rights Defense Committee?
It didn't come up at this particular demonstration. I'm not sure... So far, we have not really been involved in that. We've also started a cop watch program, which we finished our training on, and we have been out in the field. Now, this may come along, with the splinter group of cop watch, we may start battling that next, because we will be going out again Friday night.
And so cop watch, is there a number that people can call if they want to reach San Jose Cop Watch?
There certainly is. it's a voicemail, and summarize that one, but let's see, we have that right here. It's area code 408-345-327.
One more time.
408-345-2327.
2327.
Right,
And of course, now our audience is mostly here in Santa Cruz, although we may try to get this tape over to Free Radio San Jose. And broadcast it there. So
that would be great.
We also have a local, we don't really have a cop watch per se. We used to have one here, and it's since kind of fallen into the destitute. It's not actually active, but there are individuals like myself who keep an eye on what police do, file complaints, try to gather witnesses when police are being obviously abusive, and also try to deter police misconduct or getting other people to stand by and watch.
Right, that's exactly what Cop Watch is all about, just exactly what you said, Robert.
So, there were the folks chowing down outside the council meeting and drumming up a storm.
Absolutely.
What was going on inside? Any idea?
Just a lot of people coming and going. As far as the council meeting, I haven't a clue. As I say, Gary Wood was the only one, and Jessica also, the reporter, was also in there for a while. One thing I thought was very interesting to me is it was like a big picnic in the park. You know, we were sitting on the grass, on the benches, everything. We didn't see one police car, not one uniform, nothing. There was absolutely no signs of any law enforcement anywhere. I don't doubt that they weren't inside the building watching us, but they were not visible to us. So
apparently your numbers may have, shall we say, deterred any misconduct.
Also, as well, we were told by someone of authority several months ago that we've never had a problem with the police in any of our demonstrations. We were told that the police were told to leave us alone, to back off and leave us alone.
Now, how frequently does the Human Rights Defense Committee have demonstrations?
Well, we try now we're going to try. We have something else coming up, I think, soon. We try to get something about at least every 3 months. Some sort of demonstration.
Now, you say that a reporter named Jessica, I guess you told me that her full name was Jessica Lloyd Rogers.
Right.
Is writing a story for El Observador, which is a newspaper in English and Spanish?
It's bilingual. That's right.
And it comes out every week in San Jose?
Yes, every Thursday, and it will be in tomorrow's paper. In fact, she read the story to me, and it's extremely informative for anyone that, you know, wanted to know what is really happening out there with the kids. It's very informative.
Well, I understand that one of the issues that your committee is going to be following in the months ahead, and actually has been mentioned in other places, is the attempt of the San Jose Mercury News, the establishment newspaper, to essentially move in and crush these small newspapers by stealing all their advertising?
Yes, we have, we're planning a meeting on that. We're having a hard time getting everybody together. The Mercury News isn't being very cooperative as far as meeting with us and everybody else. So right now we're working on that, but that is definitely.
So it looks like neither the Mercury News nor the mayor nor the police chief are terribly excited about sitting down and talking with the people, huh?
Absolutely not. They really don't want to be bothered. You know, they have their mindset, and that's the way it's going to be, but that's always the way it's been. So we feel the only way we can get anybody to listen is to just go out in the streets and make sure people hear us. And, of course, with newspapers like the Latino Press, it's helped us tremendously. The Mercury News doesn't want to hear the facts. They don't want this type of story. So there was no one there to cover it. Channel 11 came out, but as soon as the drums started coming in, they split. I mean, they didn't want to show just how effective this could be, you know. And so Channel 14 stayed for about an hour and a half. They were out there filming. So
Channel 14 is the Spanish language channel?
Right, And they're the only ones that have really bothered, you know, to help us at all as far as any press goes.
Now, you say it was effective. Certainly the city council did not direct the police chief to start looking into the behavior of officers who were abusive to young people. There was no civil rights ordinance passed guaranteeing the rights of young people in parks to be able to drum without being harassed by armed gunmen.
Right.
So in what sense are you saying it was effective, Pat?
I think people were listening. There were an awful lot of people that were going in and out of City Hall that did take time to read the signs we had out. We had literature out on a table, and I think the drums just caught your attention, and because it was so unusual, so a lot of people were aware of why we were there. Of course, we can't let it lay. You know, we will have to continue this now and follow it through until somebody really does listen. And Jessica did have an interview with Teresa Guerra Daly, who admitted that this was a major problem with the police department.
Who is Teresa Guerra Daly?
Police auditor of San Jose.
Well, this is the hokum toy police review person?
Absolutely. Totally ineffective. You know, this is the reason we're fighting, you know, feverishly for a civilian review board, because she's totally ineffective.
Well, I hope you don't get a review board that's like the one in Santa Cruz. It is equally ineffective, and unfortunately it seems to have actually turned off the people who are concerned about reviewing the police and made them less active while persuading the rest of the community that something is actually being done when nothing of the kind is happening. That seems to be a problem with a lot of review boards in different cities. Even Berkeley's review board, one of the most powerful, having been stripped of a lot of its investigators and its staff, is really in sad shape. And
I know.
Even when it has the staff, it's kind of hogtied by its own rules, which allow for no disciplinary consequences.
I know.
And the city manager, of course, has the power to completely reverse all the decisions of the board.
And we've done a great study on all the review boards in the state of California, I think, that we could get a hold of, and we were trying to learn, you know, exactly what works. And we found just so many of them that start out okay, and then suddenly they lose power. And, of course, you have to have subpoena power, and you have to be in control. You can't have... You don't answer, I mean, to someone else. You have to be in control. It has to be your program, and you shouldn't have to, you know, nobody else should be able to say, you can't do that. Someone, you know, in an official capacity somewhere in the government, you just can't have it that way, because then it's not going to work. You might as well just forget about it.
Yeah, what I found when I was researching the subject, and I'm no expert by any means, but I found that at bare minimum you need things like public hearings, an independent and funded investigator.
Yes.
Advocates on the board without, you know, essentially who are advocating for the community and who may even have a certain skepticism of the police force.
Yes.
You're not looking for a neutral party, really. You're looking for someone who will advocate for the community. That's how I view it.
That's it. That has to be the bottom.
And then you also need independence of the city manager. And how to do that may even require an amendment of the city charter. And you may need something like prosecutorial powers.
Yes, through, that would work.
Independent prosecution, maybe a RICO Act-type prosecution, or possibly through the grand jury.
Uh-huh.
The problem is that these grand juries are often under the thumbs of the DAs, of course, who are handed
that
to the police.
Yeah, we saw that with the Gustavo Soto Mesa case when we had that open grand jury. That was just a mockery. It was an insult to your intelligence.
Briefly describe that for us.
Well, it was like a trial. It was like the district attorney had...
Remember, no one over here really has heard of Gustavo Soto Mesa, so give us the...
Sorry. He was a Latino gentleman that was shot in the back of the head by a deputy sheriff here in San Jose. The deputy had been chasing him because he thought he was driving a little strangely, and anyway, in fact, it happened just a few blocks from my house. Gustavo stopped, the deputy gets out, he's chasing him, and he claims that he wrestled him to the ground, and he doesn't know how his gun went off because the safety was on. He didn't know how the safety came off or how the gun was off. He went off. He didn't even know the gun had been fired. Now, how are you going to have... I have a .38, and when that gun goes off, it almost throws my shoulder out. So, I mean, this is totally ridiculous. And anyway, he killed him. And so they had this big investigation, and they were going to let it drop. But that's when we got involved, and we didn't let it drop. We had all these demonstrations, and finally we went to the DA, and we asked for an open grand jury hearing. Well, we put so much pressure on him that he finally gave in, and he promised us his best deputy DA, and that, you know, it naturally... they're supposed to give you a true and accurate story, but he's also supposed to be working for the people. In this grand jury hearing...
Now, this was a rarity, right? Usually grand jury hearings are not open.
This is the first that ever happened in the state of California. So we made history there, but, Robert, it was pathetic. The DA presented Gustavo as a villain, not the victim. All of a sudden, he was a villain. And the deputy, it was those, the DA were the deputy's attorney representing him. It was like a trial. It wasn't like a grand jury hearing. And in the end, this guy twisted everything around so that he brought out the fact that the deputy had been, you know, had all these honors bestowed on him. He had this great reputation, and Gustavo was a nothing. He was a hard-working man with a wife and three kids, but he was nothing. You know what I'm saying? And in the end, he said, I can't advise you what your verdict should be, but in my opinion, and he gave his opinion, which said, no, it was no fault. Now, I don't see how that could even be legal, but it went through, and so consequently, the grand jury came back, and they didn't find the deputy. He was not accountable for what happened. They bought the story that he didn't know. He's assuming that when he had the gun up by his chest, that somehow the safety got caught on one of his pens in the pocket, and it flipped the safety off, and he doesn't know how the gun went off. Now, there were some San Jose police officers in the area, and they told an entirely different story, putting the deputy at fault, where he's trying to say that they wrestled to the ground and then the gun went off. The cops are saying he was shot before they ever fell to the ground.
Well, it seems strange to me. Would a deputy ever have a gun with a safety on? I mean, that would revoke the whole purpose of having a gun while you're on duty. I mean, is that normal practice? Do police officers walk around with their safeties on the guns?
I can't imagine that.
I don't know.
Why it was said. But another interesting thing on that case, Robert, is there were some paramedics on that very street. There was a woman who was delivering a baby at that time. The paramedics were right there. And the deputies, the police officers, would not allow the paramedics to attend Gustavo, who at that time was still alive. They handcuffed him, and they had him hobbled, is that what it's called, with the ankles?
Hogtied, maybe?
He was handcuffed and hobbled after he had been shot.
And he died how long after?
Died in the hospital, but they would not let the paramedics work on him while he was there in the street.
Name of the cop who killed him?
His name was Tom Langley, Langley.
Where is Tom today?
He's still working.
Uh-huh.
Still a deputy sheriff.
But no doubt he has his safety on.
Right? Yeah, right.
I feel so much safer.
I know. I would feel much safer if he didn't have a gun at all. If he doesn't know when that gun goes off, we're all in serious trouble.
How many people under the age of 18 would you suppose, getting back to the city council meeting of last night, were actually at the meeting?
Oh, boy, I would say at least 25.
And were there parents there as well, or are these talking mostly homeless youth?
Well, I think these are mostly homeless. Now, there were some, the kids that came to us for help, they're not homeless. They're going to college here. It's kind of an exchange thing or whatever it is. But they were the college kids, the ones that were hassled considerably. But a lot of them there last night were homeless.
Well, now, what's the story about the curfew in San Jose? We have a curfew recently passed in Santa Cruz County, and they're actually looking for one in the city. That affects people if they're young. They tell them you can't be in public places late at night, even if you're doing nothing wrong.
Right.
And being there is a crime.
Yeah.
Now, is that the situation in San Jose? I mean, I know it is under the law, but the San Jose curfew law received some unfavorable publicity initially, but then after about 6 months, we didn't hear much about it. We heard the ACLU had not received any complaints.
Yeah.
What's your sense about that curfew law? How much opposition is there to it, and what's going on with that?
No, it's been too quiet, Robert. I honestly don't know, because there's nothing has been said for some time now, and I'm not really sure where it stands. I do know that the ACLU was working on it, but I've not heard any more about that. So I'm just not sure where it stands at this point. I don't know that it's even enforced, because in the neighborhood I live in, there are an awful lot of Latino youth, and they're on the streets till all hours, so I'm not really sure what, you know, I just don't know. We have, where I am now, there's a lot of gang activity, and the police don't always hang out in this area because they don't want to be where this type of thing is going on. They would rather look the other way. So I honestly, it's something I'll have to check into because I'm curious about that.
Good, I'd like to hear about it.
Okay. And that was Pat Circle of the Human Rights Defense Committee in San Jose. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM on your dial. But first, I'd like to play you an interview with activist Keith McHenry of San Francisco. This interview is actually about 3 weeks old and concerns a number of hearings that have actually already happened. But the background, I think, is very important, and we're going to also be hearing some selections from the hearings, police commission hearings around the Mark Andaya case. Mark Andaya, you'll hear described in full, as well as his victim, Aaron Williams. Keith McHenry was involved in some political controversy last week when he attended a take-back KPFA, well, actually a KPFA meeting. KPFA is a, as many of you know, a so-called listener-supported station up in Berkeley, which in recent years has become more and more corporately oriented, more and more dictatorial and censorious of its own staff. Apparently it's engaging in union busting. Numerous other accusations have been leveled against it, and Keith was present last Tuesday when there was a meeting of its board of directors, and he was apparently ordered to leave the building by Pat Scott, according to information I received on the Internet. I had a brief interview with Carol Denny, a Berkeley activist, last night who witnessed this whole situation. We'll be hopefully hearing from her later. However, the major point that I wanted to make about Keith was that he's now in jail because of an arrest that happened yesterday on Saturday, the 21st. He was attending a function called the Beggar's Banquet, a protest of Mayor Brown's urban mayor meeting. There's a meeting of the mayors up in Mayor's Conference up in San Francisco, a kind of a schmoozy, glitzy, feel-good affair. Everything's rosy from the mayors of the different cities across the country. And, of course, in San Francisco, everything is far from rosy. Homeless people face harassment for sleeping and being in public spaces at a much higher rate than they did under the supposedly more repressive Mayor Jordan, whom Mayor Brown replaced. And the Beggar's Banquet was a protest designed to bring attention to the deficiencies of Mayor Brown's administration, even as he's throwing a gala party for mayors across the country. Well, Keith, by this last report, was attempting to set up some food for Food Not Bombs when he was essentially arrested by police. They don't arrest you now for violating the injunction against serving free food, which is still on the books in San Francisco and for which I was jailed for a month last year. Rather now, to avoid that unfavorable publicity, they find another pretext to arrest you under. And Keith, they got quite a pretext. They arrested him for felony assault on a police officer. Assault with a car. Apparently they asked him to get out of his car, and then they charged him with using his car to attack police officers. This is the sort of second-hand or third-hand story I've got. He's in jail at this moment, as far as I know, being held on those charges. His friends, his partner, are all very concerned. And for folks who are interested in supporting him, you can give a call to 415-386-9209 up in San Francisco and let them know that you're with him. And if I hear more about this, I'll try to get it to Free Radio Santa Cruz during the course of the next week. Perhaps Free Radio itself could give a call and find out what's going on. In any case, Keith is an eloquent spokesperson. Well, he's not even a spokesperson for a group, since he's only one Food Not Bomber among many. But he does have a wide range of information on numerous political activities going on in San Francisco. Here he is on June 3rd discussing upcoming events and giving us the background for what turned out to be quite a, well, the most active and turbulent session of the police commission that I've ever heard of. I haven't been to many of them or seen. Hi, Keith.
Good.
Hey, Keith, what's going on today? I guess it's tomorrow. You say there's a demonstration around the Aaron Williams case. Can you
briefly summarize what's happened so far and what we should look forward to tomorrow night?
Yeah, well, tomorrow is the second anniversary of the death of Aaron Williams, who was killed in front of his house in the Richmond District in San Francisco by approximately 14 police officers. And the officer that was actually on the scene before the alleged crime had occurred, Mark Andaya, who was at Aaron's house moments before the 911 call was called in for the burglary that he ultimately was accused, Aaron Williams was accused of, these 14 officers, including Mark Andaya, pepper sprayed, emptied four pepper spray cans into Aaron Williams' face, kicked him in the head, according to Mark Andaya's lawyer, eight times. Mark Andaya kicked him in the head, and they hogtied him and put a surgical mask around his face and put him in the back of a paddy wagon and on June 4th of 95, and he was then allegedly found dead in the back of the paddy wagon an hour later in front of the police station at the Richmond District Station at 6th Avenue and Geary. And eyewitnesses, of which there was about 20 or more, said that they believed that Aaron, many of them said that Aaron was dead at the scene, that he had already was dead on the street. And that would include some of his relatives who were there, young nephews and nieces who watched him get brutally killed. So tomorrow night at the police commission meeting, there'll be a protest, and we're trying to get as many people out as possible to say that we have not forgotten about the firing of Mark Andaya. Mark Andaya was suspended for 90 days for failing to provide medical attention to a timely fashion to Aaron Williams. But really, the whole case is a case of the San Francisco Police Department systematically hiring cops from other departments who have been in trouble for murder or police violence in those departments, and instead they get transferred over to the San Francisco Police. And Mark Andaya had killed a man in Oakland when he was on the Oakland Police Force.
Who is that man?
That was Jerry Stiltz, I believe is his name. And the other thing that happened is that Mark Andaya was found guilty before the Internal Police Review Board in Oakland for kicking a man in the testicles, calling him a black-ass nigger, and for no apparent reason, according to eyewitnesses. And other officers in the Oakland police made incredible, made statements that they did not like working with Mark Andaya because he was such a racist and he was so violent, and thought that would...
But in San Francisco, apparently, they felt he'd fit in quite nicely.
Right. Blowjob Rivera, who was the former chief of police...
Why do you call him Blowjob Rivera?
Yeah, he was caught... he has a case that was pending while he was chief because he had forced some prostitutes to give him blowjobs in a patrol car while he was in uniform as a chief of police. I mean, he's an actual, the head of the...
Well, rank has its privileges.
Right, and his driver became... what happened is the driver actually testified against him when citizens noticed they're walking by this patrol car and saw Rivera getting a blowjob, and wow, this is really weird. The chief's out here getting a blowjob in the middle of the, in public here, and
part of the sexual liberation.
So that's where he gets his nickname from. Well, he had a policy of overriding the hiring department of the SFPD, and just saying, and in fact, the people responsible for hiring new officers refused to hire Mark Andaya, but Tony Rivera made arrangements to have their thing overruled. So
Andaya is back on the job, or he's been suspended for 90 days. What's the story here?
The job as of May 12th. He's been working with the with the San Francisco Police Department. He's allegedly at a desk job. He was an undercover cop, plainclothes cop, at the time of the murder of Aaron Williams.
Now, gone through a number of hearings at the police commission. I was at one of them, and actually we've gotten reports from you on some of the others. Can you summarize what the police commission, the Office of Citizen Complaints, which is your sort of citizen police review board, police commission, I guess, has more power than the citizen police review board. They could actually discipline NDIA if they chose to do so. What's happened with those two bodies?
Well, majority of the people, I think, in fact, only one person survived a house cleaning that happened because of citizen activity against the police. And
in the police commission, you mean?
No, the police commission, correct. The only person still on the police commission from the past is Pat Norman, who was a Central American activist and a lesbian rights activist here in San Francisco. And she's supposed to be part of the activist community. It's unfortunate, though, once, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of, people haven't been happy with her because she's been flirting with Democratic politics for quite some time, which, of course, is ridiculous, a waste of someone's time. But, and so there's been a sense of her being on the, you know, working with the enemy for a while.
Has the board actually done anything about NDIA? Has it excused him? Has it ignored him? Has it disciplined him? I guess you say...
They had that suspension.
But otherwise...
Otherwise, nothing has happened. There's supposed to be... There's several new, like, panels have started to, like, investigate hiring practices, to investigate things of that nature. So there's, like, essentially what has happened is the system has set up a whole bunch of different commissions. And you could actually, in the poor Aaron Williams family, Mr. Bowser and so on, have been going from hearing to hearing to hearing, because there's a hearing like every few days. And it seemed like what the idea was to burn us out so that we would be spending all of our time going to these hearings.
And is that working?
And but it's not working, because what's happened is it's become subterfuge. You know, it's a... no one has responsibility for anything. There's nothing anyone can do. And, you know, according to all these different commissions. This is a typical thing in San Francisco to give the illusion of this being a democratic and open process, but the idea is to bury you in so much time and paperwork that in the end nothing will happen to Mark Andaya. He's not having to show up to all these things. He's not, his lawyers don't have to go to most of them. It's just, this endless, it's like what we had before with crowd control. There was one of the things, the big issue I think that ultimately broke it open was the Castor riot in 89, where there was like, and then there was a spy scandal that came shortly thereafter with the Roy Bullock, Tom Gerard spy scandal. And so there was a flurry of reform in the SFPD, and they, of course, didn't, follow their own guidelines after they made all these general orders and stuff. And still to this day, the most recently on... I was an eyewitness on, it was televised on the news and on several stations, of officers swinging their clubs over their heads at people at a, on the anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr.
So that was supposedly a reform that happened that after the abusive behavior at the Castro Street riot and at this other thing you mentioned, the spy scandal, there was going to be no further clubbing people over the head with overhand blows?
Or? Right, that was supposed to, they had a new way of using their clubs, they were supposed to stop spying on First Amendment groups, just like an endless array of things, but there's been spy scandals since then, so it's not that they never really ultimately did stop spying, and they didn't stop.
So what can people who can't come to the demonstration, since it will have been over by the time we play this tape, because this demonstration is happening on June 4th, what can they do to support the relatives of Mark Andaya and the people of San Francisco who want to see genuine police reform?
Well, this is what I think would be the next move to get to...
I'm sorry, I don't mean the relatives of Mark Andaya. I mean the relatives of Aaron Williams.
Yeah,
the relatives of Mark Andaya are probably doing this well.
Yeah, I mean... doing okay, although we've been having this spat of, we had another cop kill him, the Petrini, who was the head of police intelligence, shot himself at the pistol range.
Yeah, I heard that. So. But before we go into that, or in the Williams case?
Well, in the Williams case, there's probably going to be more demonstrations. I think, in part, a way to help on the Williams case is to come to City Hall on June 17th at 1 o'clock to the Finance Committee meeting because what's of the Board of Supervisors, because this is where they're going to discuss an increase in the police budget.
Supervisors in the past has been, shall we say, critical of the policies of the mayor when Mayor Jordan was mayor, that's the previous mayor, in around issues of the treatment of the homeless population in San Francisco and of Food Not Bombs, which has, was, of course, being arrested, regularly harassed, and terrorized by Mayors Agnew and Jordan with two previous administrations. You've told us in past conversations that Mayor Brown has apparently suspended direct attacks on the feeders, the soup servers of Food Not Bombs, but that the police department, through middle-level management, has been harassing Food Not Bombs members, particularly you, or perhaps only you, I'm not sure, and some Food Not Bombs clients by giving parking tickets galore and other such sort of petty second-level harassment. Can you give us an update on that stuff?
Yeah, the thing that's gone on with the, you know, there's been a number of different things. In fact, a couple of Sundays ago, some giant guy came to my house with a club and
yeah, I heard we heard about the man with the club who apparently seemed like he might have been a cop. But
yeah,
Yeah,
the police, of course, have been needlessly no assistance in that case.
Right.
We're supposed to have a review of plainclothes cops' photos and cops' photos so that we could review, the witnesses could review it. Fortunately, however, by, you know, in a certain sense, potentially maybe because of filing a complaint.
You kind of fended off the...
they didn't ever show it back.
Guy. Anything else, any other Food Not Bombs people get suffering as a consequence of, you know, informal or sort of covert police harassment?
Mostly it seems to be the towing of my truck and the ticketing of my truck at demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be... I think it's part of a strategy of isolation, right? So that I'm always being harassed, but not nobody else necessarily is getting harassed right now. As a way of, like, distancing the community from me. That
is Food Not Bombs serving regularly? Go ahead.
Yeah, we serve every day here in San Francisco.
And is Food Not Bombs still coming to demonstrations?
Still, they're providing food at demonstrations, and...
So would you say the situation with Food Not Bombs has improved over 2 or 3 years ago?
Oh, as far as, you know, it's kind of hard to really say whether we've improved or...
Well, you're not going through the courts as much, at least in the same numbers, right?
Yeah, we don't have as much overt arrest in San Francisco Food Not Bombs or anything. I mean, we're not getting arrested at all for serving food. In fact, the harassment that was happening to me at Hayden Stanion every Monday has changed dramatically. Yesterday, a cop came by and even though I was parked where they had been telling me I wasn't allowed to park, they just said, "Hey, can you put your blinkers on now, or your flashers on?"
So apparently your complaints through Free Radio Santa Cruz have had some serious impact.
Oh, they certainly have.
Right.
Now, the things that are coming up, too, that are of interest, I think, to listeners down there, is the Mayor's Conference, National Mayor's Conference is happening in San Francisco 24th of June, and there's a protest going to be planned for that. For when that's happening. That's going to be, the meeting is today at 11, so I won't be able to report in detail what our plans are until after today's meeting.
But you'll give us an update at our next blow-by-blow.
Now, the other thing that's, another thing that Food Not Bombs here is gearing up for is, of course, right now in the Big Mountain, and with the Hopi Navajo, there's the threat of evictions should be starting any time now. Of the last traditional Diné people.
I thought that was April 1st or something.
April 1st was the day that notices were all served, and now 90 days from then is the actual evictions, and that's supposed to be starting, the first eviction should be starting now.
July 1st, though, May, June, July.
Yeah, okay, well then, yeah, what they're concerned about is the Sundance itself might, which is right now, could be, in the next few weeks, could be disrupted.
Now the Sundance is what, a traditional
Diné dance, and people have been sending out a warning that they're concerned about.
And it's supposed to happen on a particular piece of land, right, historically?
Right, so there is like a mobilization for food for that. Headwaters is another big action that is coming up in on the 14th of September. We want to, we're trying to encourage people to have to come up to Headwaters and to stop the clear cutting and the salvage logging that's happening in the Headwaters and other areas. Then another thing that I think Santa Cruz listeners would be very excited to attend is in July we're going to have a massive takeover at the Presidio. It's being organized by a coalition of groups, including Homes Not Jails, but an attempt to really push the, you know, to try to get like you know, as many buildings as possible in a very, very large action. So we're trying. We need everybody out of Santa Cruz to show up.
And the date for that is?
We don't have a date for that. I don't have a date personally for that that I know about, but I know the next planning meeting is on June 14th, Saturday, San Francisco.
Well, maybe what you can do is give us an update when that happens. I know you and I are both going to be meeting, looks like Thursday morning in court to try
right.
to... we appear at arraignments for arrests at the Presidio to try to defend Weary Housing for the Poor, Weary Housing being the, group, I guess, 466 units they wanted to demolish or relocate. That we're hoping that the public attention we brought to it by our arrests will stall that process until calmer heads and saner heads, more compassionate hearts can prevail.
Now, another thing I think is really... would be good for people to be aware of and to maybe show up at is there's going to be a Solidarity Summer Festival down in Southern California.
Oh, really? A solidarity with what?
With all the different organizations. Like the flyer that I found on Polk Street up here in San Francisco, we had Mike Novick's address was one of the addresses. He's with Anti-Racist Terror and Southern California, and he puts out Turning Tide, which is a fantastic newspaper on police brutality issues. And they're really great people, them, and there's a lot of really amazing people working on it. But the logo is around the edge of the flyer, included the Food Not Bombs logo, but it had, you know, like animal rights and all kinds of different...
When is this event happening?
That's going to be the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the 8th, 9th, and 10th of August. People, to find out more information, can call and get the information packet sent to them, can call Mike at 310-288-5003. So it's going to be bands and music, workshops, and there's a lot of free radio happening now in Southern California. It's just taking off. And the last several months, there's station after station popping up all over the both San Fernando Valley and in East LA and so on. It's very impressive.
Hmm.
Very.
Are you yourself writing a book on free radio? Is that any closer to completion?
Oh no, that's kind of on the back burner now. As I've started these two other books that are on the front burner.
What books are those?
One's the story of San Francisco Food Not Bombs, and the other is Rentis Theft is about. It's a kind of a book on skills, on you know, different organizing skills, like, and squatting skills, things like that.
Now,
there's like a free radio section in that book.
So perhaps you can update us more closely to August on what we can expect in the Southern California Solidarity Conference.
Right. It would be great for people now in the Santa Cruz area to start thinking about what they might want to bring to it. You know, what kind of workshops. You know, certainly like issues of immigrant rights are real big down there, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of...
If anybody's missing these phone numbers, by the way, you can give a call to me at 423-4833 locally in Santa Cruz, and I will get you those numbers. Keith, there's also been, of course, our traditional concern about harassment of different Food Not Bombs organizations across the state, but across the continent, because I recently been reading about Victoria Food Not Bombs getting hassled.
Really?
Yeah, it was on the internet a couple days ago, yesterday, the day before. And
I missed my article on harassment of Food Not Bombs.
I don't know. I guess that's going into Street Spirit this month.
Yeah, it just is going into Street Spirit. And
that's the homeless newspaper you can get out of San Francisco, or you can get through us, 423-4833.
Yeah, I had like a kind of a list of things that I know about. For instance, the most recent thing that I knew about in Burlington, Vermont, lost its criminal case for, and the group itself lost it. This is a very unusual situation. No person was charged with the crime of hanging a banner unlawfully in front of City Hall.
This is a Food Not Bombs banner?
Not Bombs banner, but the Food Not Bombs organization was fined $1. The judge was sympathetic to the groups. The group defended itself in court and said that it was their First Amendment right, and it was have a chilling effect on them if they were forced to get a permit to hold a to have the banner there. Mm-hmm. That was not in the spirit of the First. And said that it was their First Amendment right, and it was have a chilling effect on them if they were forced to get a permit to hold a to have the banner there. Mm-hmm. That was not in the spirit of the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, right to free speech.
Well, that was 200 and what, almost 300 years ago. Time marches on.
Yeah, that's what they're saying. But anyway, the judge was sympathetic, but did say that they in fact did really actually put a banner up and did not in fact have a permit, and therefore were technically in violation of the law. But the group's appealing that dollar fine.
Is there any resurgence of, has Arcata finally abandoned its case against Food Not Bombs up in Northern California?
Oh, I don't, that's actually sounding like a weak kind of thing up there. I'm not sure what's going on with that.
Hmm. And Carrie Chandler in Whittier is free at last, or?
Well, there's another one where I think the thing disappeared, and they have like an unofficial agreement that they, are allowed to serve food in Central Park in Whittier, but they're not to...
I'd be pleased to hear that Santa Barbara Food Not Bombs, you probably know it already since you've read the alert that the California Homeless Civil Rights Action Network sent out, has been spearheading the opposition to the sitting ban in downtown Santa Barbara along State Street.
Uh-huh.
And they are feeding regularly, apparently, every Saturday. And at some point, I'll give you their number, the guy down there, in case you don't already have it.
Great.
And
I'd love to see any email, if you could fax me, like, the brief thing of the Victoria harassment. That would be fantastic.
Sure. Well, any concluding words here, since we're getting, we got other things.
Got
to get moving along here, Keith.
Well, it's, you know, I really hope people, the proposal for the Presidio takeover.
Which is going to be happening, what date?
Well, the meeting is on Saturday the 14th at 2 o'clock at New College of Law in San Francisco.
Right, it's kind of a long way for a lot of us to go, but if you can report to us what's happening, maybe we can talk about organizing some support down here. I know some of us...
Well, our suggestion of last night's meeting was that groups start to organize their own affinity groups. So there might be a Santa Cruz housing takeover affinity group. And what that would include so far is the people that would occupy the buildings. And then so it might be going in the night before or the day before. Part of the idea is to decentralize the organizing. So if you all started to talk about getting in at night, the night before, two nights before, occupying the building, gathering your own food and resources.
And that was Keith McHenry speaking at the beginning of this month about a number of subjects. Currently, he's in the lockup for bringing food to a beggar's banquet in San Francisco yesterday. Sorry about the references to earlier times. This tape is really kind of made under time pressure, and I don't have time to edit out all the things I'd like to. But I hope that you get some useful information out of this exchange, as well as the following exchanges. We're going to now go back to Santa Cruz, where on our own streets we have some stuff happening. And lest you think that you're only going to hear the smoke-filled backroom talk or carrot-filled backroom talk of Food Not Bombs activists and other homeless folks, homeless supporters who have homes, as everybody you've heard so far does, here's some talk from the streets here in Santa Cruz about what's going on downtown. Some of you may have seen the van of Stephen Lightfoot, a fellow concerned with the murder of John Lennon, kind of a comic figure in many people's estimation, mine included to some extent. He runs around propounding the theory that Stephen King killed John Lennon. I'm not really concerned with this one way or the other. What I am concerned with that is how police have treated him in our town and in other towns. And I happened upon him as he was being surveilled by the hosts down on Pacific Avenue, I think it was 3 or 4 days ago, maybe a little bit longer. Here's a tape of what happened. It's June 17th, 1997. It's about 5:20. And we're here in front of Pizza My Heart, Acapulco, talking to
Steve Lightfoot.
And Steve, you're leaning on your van, sort of a famous white and blue van, which has numerous clippings in the windows. You have a large sign leaning against your van, overcome the human evil of your Lennon murder cover-up. And then various things are printed on the van. Stephen King shot John Lennon is the general theme.
Nixon and Reagan let Stephen King, the author of The Shining, literally pull the trigger and kill John Lennon, contrary to what we were told about Mark Chapman, who's a paid lookalike, who was never even put on trial.
Now, how have you been in town for 2 hours now?
Yeah.
How have you been? What kind of reception have you got? I see at least you had one customer purchasing the pamphlet you've written.
I don't even try to sell them. I don't even make any money on those.
Right.
However, the minute I got here, I was told to not move, not go anywhere by a fire truck who was behind me when I was parking. I gently touched his bumper, and he tried to use that as an excuse, and these hosts tried to use that as an excuse to call the police, and the police saw nothing happened, and they dismissed it. But
now, which of these gentlemen wanted to use that as an excuse to get a ticket?
The two green jackets, and maybe this undercover was with them. But hours earlier, I went through a kangaroo court on a traffic ticket. And 3 days before that, I went through a false arrest in Berkeley.
Do you think this is related to the message that you're trying to deliver?
I've been literally kidnapped and pistol whipped by police in handcuffs. I've been smashed into a sidewalk and had my shoulder dislocated by undercover cops. I've been looking down police gun barrels at least twice, including the night Reagan got reelected. I've probably been cited and ticketed and gone to court more than any law-abiding citizen in California, U.S. history. California history.
How many times would you estimate that's happened?
I've been to court 400 times for one thing or another, one procedure or another. 400 times in the last 10 years. I've been arrested about 20 times. I've not been convicted of anything. I've been accused over and over every year almost of a noise disturbance by some phantom complainant in Santa Cruz. And nothing's ever come of it. It's just a bunch of harassment. They used that as an excuse to call me a stalker on TV last year or 2 years ago. And in the spring of last year in Palm Springs, I had 21 officers in my case in 3 weeks. 4 tickets, 1 arrest, 1 tow of my van. Everything was dismissed. They still owe me for a tow on the van. They played
the same van here.
Yeah, they even pointed a gun on my face down there. It turns out Stephen King lives down there. And basically speaking, the cowardly state of California law department and law enforcement people and the courts are a bunch of yellow-bellied, short-haired sons and daughters of Tricky Dicky covering up John Lennon's murder, persecuting the messenger.
Or perhaps they simply don't like people they consider to be eccentric or cuckoo.
It's not that simple.
I'm not saying that you are. I'm saying
they want to marginalize and trivialize me in that vein. The truth of the matter is, they know that if I were given 30 minutes of uncensored time on television, it would be all I need to begin the process of arresting and jailing and convicting Stephen King. And Ronald Reagan, actually.
You may be giving these people more credit than they deserve. I think most people aren't even aware of the facts or even the allegations around it.
Well, Nixon was John Lennon's biggest enemy in life, who tried to deport him in the 70s. Now that I can prove why no one saw a trial, everyone's covering up. And I describe this whole silence of Santa Cruz as cowardly and insane.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting to me is, let's see, have you paid your meter? Let me check.
I've been paid it. I don't
want it. Your time is now expired. You better watch your step.
Yeah, I am.
But you have a few onlookers here, but interestingly enough, you have some hosts looking on, and normally the hosts are concerned about other activities. I wonder why they're spending so much time with you.
I asked them why, and they says, we have the right to be here. And then they said, why are you still here? And I was here first.
I said, well, you all have the right to be here. That's my view. Hey. Anything you want to conclude with, Steve?
How can Santa Cruz pretend to be a free society?
It isn't a free society.
Much less a liberal hotbed of social change when it falls silent in the face of what I call the conduit between tyranny and the right to know and freedom. The host, the yellow-bellied, short-haired, green-shirted, undercover narcs.
Well, that pretty much covers it, I'm afraid. Thank you, Steve.
You're welcome. Thank you, Robert.
You have my number. All right, you're taking off?
Yeah.
Okay. Enjoy the beach. I was going to ask, are you guys just sort of enjoying the day, or is there a reason you're staying here next to this guy?
We're enjoying the day.
Just enjoying the day?
Nothing to do with me being here.
So you didn't earlier threaten to call the police on him and have him arrested?
No.
No incident with a fire engine occurred?
I suppose it was exciting.
Yeah, that occurred, but we're not going to talk about it. Okay?
But there was an incident that occurred.
We're not going to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about it whether you want to talk about it or not. So, because it does involve the public. If you don't want to talk about it, you have a right to say nothing, of course. But you, as host, well, you are normally patrolling the mall. Why are you standing in one space? So this is a part of your job description, staying here for 15 or 20 minutes?
An hour.
They've been here for
an hour. Well, let's see. Yeah, it's been an hour.
Really?
Yeah.
Any other people to testify to this who are in the area? Here's
say, guys how long have you guys been here? Say, guys, haven't these guys been here all hour?
These fellas been here for a while,
these
hosts?
For an hour.
Apparently. I don't know.
You know, have you seen any interaction between the host and this man? Anything happen?
What do you got to take?
Free radio, Santa Cruz.
I don't know. I wasn't really paying attention.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's when that one guy called him an
ass. The sidewalk. But when individuals in official uniforms who are paid by the merchants specifically stand around here with the apparent purpose of intimidating one individual, that concerns me. Particularly when they don't seem to take any responsibility for what they're doing. No final statements on this, gentlemen? Well, perhaps you can identify your names for the purposes of this interview. So you're refusing to say your names as members of the host, is that correct? Okay, well, let's get a description of these individuals. We have one individual who's somewhat swarthy skinned, short, dark, flat top haircut, wearing Bermuda shorts. Then we have another woman, again dressed in a similar manner, Bermuda shorts, wearing sunglasses. A flat top haircut.
In a leg bandage.
In a leg bandage, thank you very much. So my concern is that members of the host identify themselves to the public when asked to do so. Perhaps you can tell me who your superior is. You're also refusing to say the name of your superior, is that correct? I think so. That seems to be what you're doing. This is the basis of a complaint, and I'll go make one right now. Thank you.
Contact the Downtown Association.
So you won't take a complaint, is that correct?
I don't know what to do. I've never had a complaint before. You need to talk to our supervisor.
Basically, we are not going to be giving you any information. If you want to talk to someone, go to the DMC. Talk to them.
I'm simply trying to file a complaint about what you're doing, that's all.
I would talk to the DTA or the DMC.
Okay.
I know
we didn't do anything wrong, so you can file a complaint.
Well, you're
you know?
Standing a quarter of a block away from your headquarters.
I'm not supposed to be in my office.
I think if a member of the public wants to do some business with you, that's where you should be. So you... I mean, you're obviously lollygagging around out here. I mean, you know, your office is closed. So are you refusing to go to your office? I can wait outside the office till someone shows up.
I'm sitting there, but I don't know what you're gonna do.
I just want to file a complaint. I'll just write out a complaint, and you can give it to the Downtown Management Corporation. That sound okay? So eventually I was able to persuade the woman and her male companion to go inside and give me a piece of blank paper. But as you can see, it took a lot of energy to do that, and I would say ordinary individuals not used to pressuring bureaucracies, I've had a lot of experience trying to pressure bureaucracies and sometimes successfully to do their job. For those who don't have that kind of experience, that kind of patience, that kind of time, it's obviously a dead end. People who are working for the city should identify who they are, at least by number, if not by name. And these two eventually did identify themselves by number. But it was like pulling teeth. It showed that they were obviously inappropriately trained, that they somehow felt guilty about what they were doing.
and they therefore were refusing to give simple information. They wouldn't give the name of their superior. It's all on tape, and it's all pretty clear. In fact, I haven't yet filed a complaint about this, mainly because I've had other things to do. I probably will next week. It's a minor thing, but in my mind, those who are entrusted with the power to intimidate must also be responsible, and they must be subject to public scrutiny. That's the problem with police forces across the country, as you've heard from other speakers here, other people we've interviewed. So let's get back to the mall and hear some more stories about how common folk are treated downtown.
Jamie Rogers.
And Jamie, here we are in front of the beautiful Del Mar, and you say you got a ticket down the road?
For crossing our dog across Pacific, running as fast as we could run, and the lady followed us after we got done. Yeah, we were grocery shopping, and we came back out, and then she ticketed us.
And who, was this a police officer?
Yes, it was a female police officer.
Do you know her name?
No. Do you not remember her name?
Do you have the ticket with you?
Nope. We threw it in the trash.
And the name of your dog?
Is Zeus.
And
he's a Rottweiler. He's a full-blooded German Rottweiler.
And what did she say to you around this whole issue?
She said that you could... She said, I caught ya. Really, that's what she said.
Had you been walking up and down the mall with your dog?
No, not at all.
Had you been, shall we say, tossing your dog back and forth for cat?
No.
And
no.
Should we say throwing poo-poo all over the street?
No, we are totally respectful citizens of this county, and we were simply crossing the street to go get some food.
Weren't you having sexual behavior with your dog?
No, nothing. Although he'd probably lied to you, no.
So,
not in public, we weren't.
And you were also present when this happened?
Yes, it was...
Your name is?
Donald Arlo Guthrie.
Donald Arlo.
My name is Donald Guthrie.
Oh, Donald.
Yeah.
Okay. So, when did this happen?
This happened last week.
Last week. Yes. Our truck broke down over here. We've never been here in our life. And that happened. But it was all right. It's the way the law is. But see, there's other things to be doing. There's crack dealers, there's rapists, there's murderers, there's speeders.
There's dog walkers.
You know, there is.
The matter is, there's laws, and there's a reason why dogs aren't allowed on Pacific Street. But we weren't hanging on Pacific Street. We were crossing Pacific Street.
We
were on, actually, if you look at it in terms, the next street down, in terms, we were on that street. Pacific Street just happened to be a cross street.
So, do you remember the actual, is it this street here where you were?
We went to that corner, and, was it this corner, Jamie?
No, it was the one right by the movie theater.
The next one down.
The Cinema 9.
Yeah, we made sure we walked from all the way here, from this corner down here,
right,
all the way down on the alleys, and then we got to that corner, and we were crossing over to go to Long's and to the grocery store, and she chased us from up here, ran down there, waited for us to come out of the store and ticketed us. And, like I said, I don't have the ticket. I threw it away because it's not at the top of my priority.
We advise that within a month there'll be a warrant, but probably not until then.
I understand that.
Thank you, and I'm sorry to hear it.
It happened.
Sounds like Santa Cruz.
Say that again? Now we have to leave him tied up in the parking lot, in the shade.
And he's worth tons of money. He's a full-blooded German Rottweiler. He's worth thousands. So who knows if our dog's going to get stolen, if someone's going to get bitten. No one's going to get bitten, but stupid people act stupidly. You know what I mean? And they approach dogs totally wrong, and they make them feel threatened or whatever. So, you know.
Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
This kind of harassment of citizens, failure of hosts and police to be accountable, the sweeping of people away from the downtown areas, and of course the ongoing refusal of the city council to pay any attention to the realities of homeless people at night who are faced with the Santa Cruz City sleeping ban, which makes it illegal to sleep outside after 11 on penalty of $162 fine for the first offense, and endless harassment and threats of misdemeanor jury trial for the second offense within 48 hours. The refusal to respond to these homeless realities has put people in a position where they face a difficult situation each day if they're poor and without means. And there are more than 750 people for less than 30 floor spaces in the summer, the late spring and the early fall here in Santa Cruz as far as emergency shelter goes, or even just a legal place to be at night and sleep. Because of the situation, some groups are talking about a demonstration, and Jim Costner of the Revolutionary Coalition has announced a planning meeting tomorrow, that's Monday, June 23rd at 8 o'clock in Loudon Nelson Park. That's Laurel Park, as it used to be called, down there next to the Loudon Nelson Center. So if you want to help plan for a 4th of July rally, apparently he's thinking of tabling up and down the mall, thinking of some sort of almost like a fair-like event to be concluded with a sleep out that night, and perhaps a traditional flag burning. Don't know what that's all about. Jim can talk to you about that. Come on down to Loudon Nelson Park tomorrow, June 23rd, Monday, at 8 o'clock. If you want further information on this and you want to volunteer, call 421-9250. The issues, again, are civil rights for the poor in Santa Cruz and civil rights for oppressed people around the country, with specific focus on Big Mountain, Mumia Abu-Jamal and his and political prisoners being held in jails throughout the country, and who knows what else. My particular concern and interest with this July 4th demonstration is to dramatize the fact that nothing has come out of City Council in spite of some fine words at the March 4th City Council homelessness special session, to be followed by essentially a big zero on May 27th, when Kennedy's recommendations were mostly voted rubber-stamped by the City Council. And we have no mention of the criminalization of the poor and no mention of the need for emergency shelter in any significant way. The City Council is doing what it's always done, ignoring the issue, hoping it goes away, and letting the police harass people as they choose. Now, not every city does this. There are some cities that are in the midst of fighting for their rights. In Santa Barbara, as you've heard in past shows, the Santa Barbara activists, led by Food Not Bombs, sympathetic attorneys, if you can believe that, and old-time homeless activists like Beaming Bob Hansen have been fighting their sit ban. Sit ban is also under attack in Palo Alto, where it's currently not being enforced, even after it was passed in late April, and in San Jose, as was the case at City Council last Tuesday. You're going to hear more about that City Council fight. But there are also cities that have actually forced the City Council to turn back the law, or not even to pass the law. And I got a clipping from a Colorado newspaper from Boulder, Colorado, and I'd like to read you that story today to give us a little heart. And it's titled, City Won't Stand for a Sitting Law. Killed proposal labeled Elitist Attack on the Homeless by Wayne Logison, Boulder Planet. A proposed ordinance to outlaw sitting on University Hill and Pearl Street Mall was killed Tuesday, June 3rd, when a motion to adopt it failed to get a second. City Councilman Bob Greenlee moved to adopt the ordinance after 65 people spoke to the council, with only about 5 expressing support for the proposal. Most, including an array of business owners and attorneys, characterized the proposal as an elitist and unconstitutional attack on the homeless and economically disadvantaged. After the proposal failed to get a second, Mayor Leslie Durgin encouraged the community to work together towards resolving concerns about loitering and pedestrian mobility in commercial areas. Earlier in the day, about 100 critics of the proposal gathered on the Boulder County Courthouse lawn on Pearl Street Mall, a few taking turns to speak out against the law through a public address amplifier. Everybody knows this will be enforced in a discriminatory manner, said Kevin Rooney, a Japanese translator and former City Council candidate. We have fair laws in this country that apply to everyone. What the law says is we will no longer do that in Boulder. Advocates say the law would make it easier for shoppers to get around in commercial districts and give police a new tool to deal with people who live on the streets and create a frightening, uncomfortable atmosphere. Ben Bender criticized local businesses for opposing most government regulation but supporting the proposed sitting law. The business community is always bitching and moaning about arduous government regulation, but when you give them a shot at it, they make it illegal to sit down, Bender said at the protest rally. Adam Chase, chairman of the Boulder chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, said the proposed law was downright disingenuous and would represent cruel and unusual treatment of the homeless. Boulder doesn't want the homeless in the business community, and that's just not the Boulder I grew up with, Chase said at the rally, evoking cheers from the crowd. The proposal was inspired by a 1994 Seattle ordinance, which has been upheld by a federal district court and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. That's called the Roulette Decision for all of you legal buffs. Similar laws have been adopted in 5 other cities. And apparently Adam Chase is not only a speaker and chair of the ACLU, his ACLU actually does something, unlike certain other ACLUs, such as our own local ACLU, which has abandoned the fight against the sitting ban here in Santa Cruz, and I believe that they've also abandoned it in Santa Monica, where a similar sitting ban was strengthened and expanded on June 10th. That's down in Southern California. But here's Adam Chase writing about sitting as a basic human right in a column called Speak Out. The Boulder County chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, an association established to maintain and advance civil liberties, resolutely opposes the City of Boulder's proposed ordinance, BRC 5311. If enacted, the ordinance would criminalize sitting or lying down on the sidewalks of Boulder's downtown mall or University Hill. Boulder already has its laws on its books, at least two laws, laws that prohibit the blocking of the public right-of-way and that make it illegal to aggressively panhandle, that adequately address the problem at hand. We do not need this proposed ordinance. The ACLU opposes 5311 because it does not address its stated purpose, is unnecessary, infringes upon fundamental civil liberties, and sends the message that Boulder seeks to fence out the homeless while being inhospitable to disfavored groups in society. The ACLU is concerned about the establishment of a status crime that makes the basic activity of sitting or lying down upon a public sidewalk or the mall, upon a blanket, chair, stool, or any other object, to give the language of the ordinance, a crime punishable by 90 days in jail or a fine of $1,000. As a side note, I'll note that Santa Cruz has a sitting ban that makes a first offense punishable as an infraction, usually $162. Second offense within, I believe it's a month, punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. That law means if you sit anywhere 10 feet from a shop, 50 feet from a change-making machine, 4 feet from a drinking fountain or telephone downtown, you can be ticketed or arrested. Getting back to Adam Chase's Boulder, Colorado article, we are also concerned that the proposed ordinance is an invitation for selective enforcement. While an identical ordinance in Seattle withstood a facial challenge as to its constitutionality, the ACLU has serious doubt that the ordinance would survive judicial scrutiny when enforced. The ACLU has a strong history of defending the rights of those who have chosen alternative lifestyles and have opted to express their ideas through their public presence in prominent public areas. Although many may find objectionable the ideas and expressions of rainbows, grass eaters, fish heads, grunges, hippies, street people, and other transient groups, the ACLU views their non-intrusive physical presence as a form of expression protected by the First Amendment. In addition, the ACLU fiercely defends the rights of individuals to sit in the lotus position and meditate, kneel in prayer, or engage in political protests through sit-ins on Boulder's public sidewalks, so long as these exercises do not infringe upon the rights of others. The stated purposes of the anti-sitting or lying ordinance are either disingenuous or do not stand up to scrutiny. The declared purposes of the proposed measure boil down to 1. The reduction of congestion and barriers to pedestrians, especially elderly, disabled, and vision-impaired pedestrians, and 2. The promotion of a community and neighborhood atmosphere fostering community life, interaction, and integration. This ordinance is not targeted at the specific behavior it seeks to discourage, is likely to fail to achieve its stated objective, and is overly broad. If the City Council wishes to reduce obstruction of the public right-of-way, it should do so by assuring the enforcement of an existing ordinance that prohibits the impeding of sidewalks and traffic. If that law is perceived to be ambiguous or otherwise requires fine-tuning, then we suggest that Council refine the existing ordinance rather than making basic and harmless conduct a crime. Similarly, if people are offended by aggressive panhandling, the City need only enforce the laws that make such conduct illegal. Again, I'm going to pause to note that Santa Cruz, of course, passed these laws in 1994, and in spite of its great liberal city council, great progressives on the council, has taken no action, and there's been none led by Byers or Scott, the greatest of the great liberals on the council, to change or speak out against these laws. As a consequence, businesses have grown bolder, police officers have grown more repressive. We have seen the destruction of a culture at Cathcart and Pacific. There are no people there anymore to speak of. You get occasionally people hanging around here and there in front of Starbucks. How exciting, our new chain store spot in front of the coffee roasting company. But actually, it's technically illegal for a musician to be in front of those sidewalk cafes if the sidewalk cafe decides they don't want them. So has the privatization of our sidewalks, of our downtown community public spaces, proceeded. So when people don't speak out, you get this gradual descending repression. And that's what's happening. And that's not enough for the businesses. As you've seen, they've been passing out little yellow cards to give away, and you can still find these in any business downtown. And I advise you to walk into a business and ask for one of those little yellow real change, not spare change, as they amusingly call this program. Of course, it's no change at all, except to hustle the spare changers and anyone else who looks poor down the road out of public spaces so as not to alarm what they consider to be the most desirable sort of tourist, those who want to imagine that they can live in their own living room when they walk down the street without dealing with the reality of homeless people, with the reality of poor working class people, and so forth. So I think it's really interesting to read over something from a city that actually successfully defeated a sitting ban, or actually crushed it before it started. A town not terribly unlike our own in terms of its proximity to, its liberal reputation, its progressive organizations. Boulder, Colorado, is Eugene, Oregon, Santa Cruz, California are all often compared with each other. We have to consider strong public action as they did, and they had public microphones, a public address system on the lawn for hours before the city council met. We, of course, did demonstrations, and we were ignored by the Kennedy, Rotkin, Matthews Council. We have the same folks in there now pressing for a youth curfew in Santa Cruz. So if you're under 17, you're going to be forced to go home late at night or be forced to deal with the police. And the curfew is not only going to extend to young people, it's going to extend to businesses to demand that they act as little police agents and start carding and IDing everybody after a certain hour. This is Scott Kennedy of the Resource Center for Nonviolence who's pushing this law, or from whose public safety committee this is emerging with a unanimous vote, according to the Santa Cruz Sentinel. And I encourage you to come to the city council meeting on Tuesday, June 24th, that's in 2 days, to keep your eye on this. It'll be the evening session, starts at 7, you can come and speak at oral communications, and then sometime later that law may be introduced. Unfortunately, I can't tell you if it's actually on the agenda. I don't have the agenda at the moment. The agenda can be picked up at the city clerk's office. That's right at City Hall. Unfortunately, it only comes out usually around 4 o'clock on Fridays. Unless you're down there in that last hour, you don't get a copy of the agenda. I wasn't down there. My apologies. Maybe every second and fourth Tuesday when the council meets, those of you who are interested in the city council can get down there, get a copy of the agenda, and, hey, let us all know what